for a funny story. But I actually don't find water that funny, but I love water. I'm a native of the Pacific Northwest. I grew up near Puget Sound. My family always boated, and so I think I have this pretty strong affinity. And my one claim to fame is that when I was six, and I won't tell you how long ago that was, I caught the biggest salmon on Puget Sound in the fishing derby. It was a 31-pounder, and of course, I didn't pull it up. And when my father and grandfather got it on the boat, I wouldn't touch that slimy thing. I think you probably also have memories and experiences about water. So I'd just like you to think about what value water has for you. What are your favorite places near water? And what kinds of experiences do you have in the urban environment, especially, that you enjoy? Can we have just a couple of responses that come to mind quickly? Anybody? Wake up.
The fountain at the Seattle Center.
The fountain, yeah. People love to run and play in that. Another one.
Golden Gardens.
Golden Gardens on the beach. Great, thank you. So just kind of keep thinking about these. So water, of course, is a necessity. We need it for all of our life functions. And I like to say that we have three waters. We have the clean drinking water source. We also have water we have to deal with, the byproducts of stormwater, both in quantity and quality we have to think about. And then we have our sewage, and that's gray water. That's the kind of dishwasher and hand washing and things like that, as well as sewage, which we call black water. And here's a village in Switzerland where the center, it's my husband and daughter a few years back, the center is always the well, right? That's the center necessity of life. Water is also habitat, of course, with all these different kinds of habitats, streams, rivers, wetlands, lakes, ponds, beaches, estuaries, bays, you name it, down back to the ocean. And here's just an image of a local wetland. And the third idea here is that water really provides pleasure for us. It's an amenity. It provides sensory pleasure, like the Seattle Center Fountain, provides recreation, like Golden Gardens Beach, and it provides meaning for us. We are creatures of water. We came from the sea. We are innately, it's been documented, innately drawn to water. And I love this quote, if there's magic on this planet, it is contained in water. This is not urban. This is the Cedar River Watershed Education Center. And unfortunately, this blurry drawing on the left is a video that plays on my Mac, but won't play on here. So you just have to imagine these rain drums. Dan Corson worked with our team. He was the artist. And there are little droplets that play these rain drums all at in symphony. He's collected rhythms from around the world. So it's not real rain, but it's computer drops. And so when you stand there, you just hear this symphony of drums being played by the water. With water, we have sort of Goldilocks syndrome, that we have to have the right amount at the right times, or it causes problems, like the flooding that we get. And we like to be able to predict where it's going to be, where it is at certain times, so that we can arrange our lives, our cities, our transport, all of our activities around it. And here is just with a 3-meter sea level rise, which by 2200 there could be, or earlier if climate change predictions are speeded up. This is looking down the Duwamish, looking north to Seattle. You can see Seattle up in the top. And just with a 3-meter sea level rise, this is, you know, Seattle will definitely have to change. Most of our big cities are located on or near a water body. It might be a river, it might be a lake, Chicago. Many are located on estuaries. Here's Seattle. And some of our favorite cities that we like to travel to are cities of water. How many people have been to Amsterdam? Yeah, so you know Amsterdam. The top is Vancouver, and then, of course, Venice, the ultimate water city. Copenhagen also is a city on water. Sydney, the icon of the Sydney Opera House. And Suzhou in China is sort of the Venice of China. And as I said, their cities are located on water very often, and so therefore they're located in very important aquatic habitat areas, especially estuaries, which are considered the breadbasket of the ocean. It's where a lot of the food is produced, where juvenile salmon and other species rear. And in Seattle, in particular, we have this passageway. My pointer is sort of temperamental here. Well, you can see, here we go. There's passageway to go up the Lake Washington watershed. Fish can go all the way up to the Cedar River, not all the way to the lake, but they can go up, or up the Duwamish, and that's the whole Green River Duwamish Basin. So both of those are major spawning habitat. And the juvenile salmon of some species, especially sockeye, really like to hang out in lakes. So the whole system is important, yet they have to navigate through as adults and especially back down to rear as juvenile around these urban environments of the city. So we have these particular challenges in urban situations with water. To satisfy these three systems, and I'll say right up front, these are not the only systems that we use for water. We use water for transport and industry and ports and all those things. But these are the three that I'm focusing on today. The resource for human use and health, for aquatic ecosystem integrity, and then as an urban amenity. And as an urban amenity, it's very important, not just for livability and our pleasure, but also that we're creating cities that I like to call magnet cities, that when we live in together in cities, our overall ecological footprint is smaller. Do you know what I mean when I say ecological footprint? The impact that we have on the planet through our living, our heating, our traveling around, all of our activities, the amount of land it consumes, the amount of energy it consumes, the kind of carbon emissions, and pollution and all that. So it's smaller when we live together in cities. And of course, we have sort of an opposite pattern, or have been having an opposite pattern, where we sprawl out. And that sprawl then consumes more land, it takes more vehicle miles traveled, more carbon emissions, more petrol consumption, all that. So a good formula for sustainability around the world is to make great cities. And I like to call them magnet cities. This formula is that if you have density, or I think a better term for that is intensity, that's density when it's really done right, plus amenities make great cities. And when people live in cities, it's a more sustainable solution. Of course, you could end up with cities like Sao Paulo that aren't great cities and people have to live there. And that's not the aim here. The aim is to make great cities so people will want to live in them. And Mike Houck says, in livable cities lies the preservation of the world, building on that Thoreau quote. So that's sort of the premise that I work on with urban design. So today's talk is to hit 4 points. The first one's just about finish. That's this whole idea of urban water and meeting multiple needs together. Then I'll take you on some armchair traveling of looking at examples of water and urban design. Then I'm going to show you very briefly a project the Green Futures Lab is just starting on, and finally some principles that we might think about and use as we plan, design, and manage water. So here's this triad, a diagram of these three water needs. First is that we have human resource infrastructure, and byproduct. Second is the aquatic habitat. And third are the amenities for livable magnet cities. You'll see this little icon appear again. I think I explained that well enough. Do you all get that idea that we need? Let me go back one more. The idea here is that we need to be thinking not just about one of these, but what we're really aiming for is this spot in the middle. So, okay, we can plan just for drinking water and stormwater, you know, getting it away from our houses and our cities as quickly as possible, or we could plan just for aquatic habitat, or we could say, oh, we're just going to have beautiful fountains in the city, and that's all. But these beautiful fountains might take the water that we need for drinking or aquatic habitat, or byproducts of stormwater or sewage might degrade aquatic habitat, or might take the water out of the rivers, like in the Cedar River, where Seattle gets its water, exactly when the fish need the water in that river. So what we're aiming for here in urban design, planning, and management is the sweet spot, right? We're trying to find projects that do at least two of these things. So if we have pleasure, it's maybe integrated with our drinking water, or it's with creation of habitat, and ideally, we get all three of those. So that's the premise of the talk, really. All right, now get your bags packed and do some traveling. We're going to start out in Sydney, Australia. Then we're going to go to New Zealand. It's a Christchurch and Wellington, two pretty sizable cities in New Zealand. I think then to Copenhagen, Seattle, and actually Portland too. Dot covers both. And then back to Sweden, Malmö, Sweden, which is just across the bridge from Copenhagen. And the first set we're going to look at are parks. So this is the Sydney Olympic site, which is now a giant park, much like Seattle Center, which is now a big park after Seattle World's Fair. This park, just about everything you see is the park. Here are all the stadia. There are these huge wetland systems that I'll show you some photographs of and habitat. And there's even housing that was the Olympic housing. And that's actually seen as part of this whole planned development. I think what it's most remarkable for is its integrated water system. All of the water on this site is collected, treated, and reused. So even its sewage. They take the sewage, they mine the water out, they clean it in this little facility, and then they pipe it back. It's clean enough to drink, but it's not used as drinking water. It's used for irrigation, for toilet flushing, for the fountains in the facility, anything that's not potable. And it's just this one little water facility that does it. Stormwater is cleaned and stored. This is a really cool thing. This is an old quarry. They were going to develop it as part of the Olympics until they found an endangered frog, the green golden bell frog. And they said, oh, no, we better not disturb that. But they use it as storage for extra water that's cleaned here as well as clean stormwater. And then that water is pumped back, and you can see in the sink or the toilets, pumped back to the public facilities as well as to that housing that I showed you, because there are double pipes and people can use it to wash their cars or whatever. This also has this very cool walkway, and I'll show you another image of it. So you can enter onto this and walk around and look down. There's also been extensive habitat restoration there all throughout. This is just a view from one of the person-made hills. This is looking down from that walkway. This is the boardwalk through a mangrove swamp that was preserved, and then wetlands that were created with a blind so that you could look at the bird life there. Very, very rich biota. There's also plenty of design there for urban amenities and pleasure. This is the entry to that walkway, the frog ring. Here are some fountains, beautiful fountains. This is another one where the water is surprising this kid, and this is all from that recycled source. And here I think are a couple of examples that do hit that sweet spot well. The frog ring, here's the great human amenity that you're up there looking down. It's got habitat, but it's part of this water reuse system. And then this is part of that fountain I just showed you, where part of that is not so prim and proper. It's actually integrating wetlands in, using this reclaimed water into the human amenity. All right, that was Sydney. Now we're just going to jump across the water and go to Christchurch. Christchurch in 1999 decided to reorganize their drainage department. They had just a traditional drainage department. The city is city's about 350,000. Located over a bunch of springs with two rivers, so surface water is very close to the surface. And they decided to reorganize and say, you know, instead of just addressing drainage, how about if we get more value out of our system? So they said, okay, we're going to address six values simultaneously. I think The program is really a poster child. They've said every project needs to satisfy landscape, overall beauty of landscape, ecological aspects, recreation, culture. There's a very strong Maori culture there, as well as his heritage, which is both Maori and settlement history. Oh, yeah, and drainage, too. So a couple of projects from Christchurch. This is just a Google Earth image of the Addington neighborhood, which is a low-income neighborhood, very close to those springs. And they had flooding problems. So how are they going to deal with their flooding problems? Well, they said, we could actually take some of that surface water off the streets, which we can't get the fall in the pipes to get it away fast enough. And at the same time, we'll clean it, so we have clean waters going into the Avon River. This is an image of a street. This is a corner crossing, and these are rain gardens. So the water actually goes into the curb. I think you're starting to see these rain gardens around Seattle. I'll show you some, too, in Seattle and Portland. Goes in here, and this is like a big storage vault, but it's got planted. But at the same time, the street is raised, so there's good pedestrian crossing. It's narrowed. These curb bulbs pinch it down. And that starts to make a neighborhood, feels like a neighborhood. It's not just cars going around, but it's a neighborhood that's good for walking and pedestrians. On Google Earth here, you can see they also then bought out a bunch of houses. All along in here is a park now. So instead of there being houses, some of it was park before, but instead of it being houses, it's taken out, and the park has multiple uses as well. Before I go to the next slide, I just want to point out some of these street crossings, like here, here's the curb bulb, here's a major crossing that's pinched down with these rain gardens where the park crosses, here's another one. So it's all departments working together, streets as parks and this drainage department. Here's some image of part of that swath that was taken through. Just it was winter when we were there, so there's nobody in the park. But this linear swath that has this water swale that can actually hold water and clean it. It infiltrates into the ground. Any excess goes out through this big culvert, which looks like it's historic, but it actually has a date on it, 2006. And as part of it, they've integrated play equipment. You can see one of those big vaults here and how the water is stored, infiltrated, and excess carried out. And then they've integrated art. This is part of the culture, right? So the neighborhood happens to have names of authors and artists. So this is Kipling. Well, this is Kipling sitting on a bench. And then here's a spring. You can look down and actually see the water down in the spring. They put this open grate there. And here's a pump that you can actually pump. So it's got this interactive quality of helping people to understand their neighborhood a little bit. And then in the same neighborhood is a park. It was an existing park, and they said, well, let's see if we can make that work for drainage, too. So this is a swale here, and it goes under a bridge. It wraps around the outside of this big tree here so it wouldn't disturb the roots. And then this all from the top of this to the left, all the way over the top of here, functions as a big detention basin. So and when it rains a lot, all the water is stored there, and then it just very slowly will be, the flow is what we call attenuated, and it's slowly released so that it doesn't flood the Avon River. And then art is integrated. One of the icons in New Zealand is the cabbage tree, and so this cabbage tree is sort of built upon in this pretty cool piece of art, I think. The goddess cabbage tree. So that's Christchurch. Now in Wellington, which is the capital of New Zealand, it's a smaller city, but it's a rather amazing city. If you ever go to New Zealand, definitely go to Wellington. This map shows just the outer green belt. It actually also has an inner green belt, and the major city is located right around the harbor here. It also this is sort of an urbanized area, but we're going to be looking around the harbor here. And this photo is taken from Mount Victoria right there, looking across to the harbor. And, Wellington is remarkable for many things, partly its open space system, which is just fantastic. And that includes the waterfront. So they've actually worked on all of their waterfront. There's a public promenade that goes all the way across. And this is a newer section in Oriental Bay that really addresses all different users. It's a fantastic walking and biking path. They've made a new beach there, so that has amenity as well as some habitat value. And then they've built this pier of platforms that is great for walking out on, but it's also great habitat. You can see all the seaweed that's attaching to it. All that then is substrate for producing food for aquatic species. So I think it's a pretty cool project. And then just a little bit up the waterfront, so this is the water here, is Waitangi Park. We'll come back to this at the end. This is also a new park. What's remarkable about it is that these are all water quality swales. It takes the water as a stormwater from the hillside that goes into a stream. It's all collected. It's all dirty. It takes it, it pumps it up, it moves it through some sand filters, and then it finishes cleaning it in the swale that wraps around the edge of the play area. It's got a skate park and all sorts of good things. And at the end, which is just off to the left here, is a giant cistern in the ground, and that water is now clean, and it's used for irrigating the lawn. So it's a closed-loop system. That means no drinking water is needed to irrigate the park, and the water that was dirty, storm water, it's got all those petroleum hydrocarbons, etc., is cleaned before it goes out to the bay. Not all of it is used for irrigation. So now we're going to leave New Zealand and go to Copenhagen. You with me? Still? Okay. this is the inner city of Copenhagen. And this is the harbor out here. And actually it looks like a river that goes all the way through. We're going to look at a project that's actually on the edge. You can't really see it on Google Earth because it's also new. And then it does have this inner photo I showed you before. It was of this inner ring, actually in here, this here, and we'll look at the harbor here. So it's a really big deal in Copenhagen that you can now swim in the harbor. It's not necessarily warm. It's not quite as cold as Puget Sound, but it was really just too polluted to swim. And that's because, like much of Seattle, there's sanitary sewer and their storm sewers were combined. They're connected. So whenever they'd get a big rain, too much water, what would happen? Well, the system couldn't handle it. And just like Seattle, that sewage goes off to the local water bodies. Do you know that happens in Seattle? So big rain, and it'll go into Lake Washington. More likely, it'll go into Elliott Bay, because that's where most of the combined sewer outfalls are. So they've been working really hard for the last 20 years in Copenhagen to, there's a head back there, to clean up the bay. And 20 years ago, the drainage planner said, let's see if we can make the bay clean enough to swim in. And the mayor laughed. And now it's just the hugest thing that there is this really cool platform that they call, there's harbor swimming baths, and this is one of three. The newest one. There's the diving platform, and there's a new waterfront park. The swimming baths are right here. I know it's blurry, but that's where they are. This is taken from one of the bridges. So wouldn't it be great if we could actually swim comfortably in Lake Union? Think about it. If we didn't have all that storm water going into Lake Union. I don't think we have sanitary sewers going in there, but actually we do. Yeah, there are combined sewer overflows into Lake Union, so it could be a great goal for Seattle. So anyway, here's the Harborfront Park. It's a great park. And then this new beach that I pointed out was off the Google Earth image, which is a 4-kilometer beach that has been created. It was too shallow to really swim comfortably there. You had to wade way out. So they just totally reconfigured the landscape. You can see, I think you get a good sense of it here. Part of it is really for human use, and part of it is where habitat has very carefully been restored to be dune for beach species. This is a bit of a diversion, but I think it's really worth saying. Copenhagen also has this fantastic cycling system. 55% of the people who live in the city use cycling to commute. So why is that important to water? Why would using a bike instead of a car be have anything to do with water? Anybody have an idea?
Stormwater pollution.
Stormwater pollution's definitely one. Definitely. Another one? Think of the carbon emissions that cars give off. And that then will have warming temperatures. And when water gets warmer, then it won't be able to support the species that need cold water, like salmon, right? Salmon is a cold water species. So it's of great concern that salmon habitat, like Lake Washington, is warming up. So Copenhagen has this goal of, actually now 37% of people who commute from outside the city use a bicycle, and their goal is 50%. And 70% of the residents continue cycling in the winter. And that's because the city prioritizes it. They plow in the winter. They plow the bike paths first. So I think we have a mayor who could get us there if we get on board in Seattle. It is flat in Copenhagen. And they do have raised bicycle tracks. But anyway, so there's some sort of relationships that are off. You wouldn't think about necessarily affect water, but they do. All right, coming home, some projects in Seattle that have to do with water. One is, actually there are quite a few restoration projects in the Duwamish. Excuse me. One is Herring's House Park, which is right here. This was a very polluted brownfield site that was a sawmill. And because the Duwamish River waterway used to be actually a river, but now it's just a straightened waterway, every opportunity to create new estuarine habitat is being taken. So this was actually totally carved out to create this new park, which is a nice park to walk in, but it's especially great as new tidelands for the species of salmon and the aquatic vegetation that need that kind of tidal and shallow tidal situation and shallow water. Similarly, when Olympic Sculpture Park was built, the shoreline had new attention given to it. Have all you been to Olympic Sculpture Park? Seattle's great. Oh, you should go. It's just Seattle's greatest new urban space, which used to be a brownfield, and it bridges the highway and the railroad, so you can start here and you can walk all the way down. And then this waterfront path connects with the waterfront path that goes all through Myrtle Edwards and connects to the downtown. But why I put this in here is because the museum, along with many other entities, the county, the state, funded not only the sculpture park, but this retrofit of the seawall and the urban waterfront. So they created a pocket beach here. And then, if you can see that there's some bulk kelp floating here, they created a new bench along here, a shallow bench. Now, why do you need a shallow bench? Well, that's because in Puget Sound, there are exotic species, like a fish, that predate upon the juvenile salmon. And the way that the juvenile salmon can get away is to go into the shallow areas. Excuse me, I think I better take a drink. So that's why at Herring's House Beach Park, that beach was formed. Likewise here, a new beach. There's a photo of the new beach. So they just broke that seawall down. They took off the riprap, laid back the slope so that the tide comes up and down, and then those small fish can hang out there, and the big fish can't get them. Likewise, this bench, if you just think about it, it's a terrace, an underwater terrace. It's shallow. It's shallower there, especially as the tide goes down. Plus, it's, of course, a great urban amenity. So they're monitoring there, and just overall, it's University of Washington doing the monitoring. It's showing that there are more juvenile fish than reference sites, and what was there before, more invertebrates and more species of algae. So it seems to be pretty successful. All right, so those were all parks. Now we're going to look at some more hardened, built-out places, streets, buildings, and plazas. And but stay in Seattle. And we're going to start out with creeks. And I just said we're going to do built things. Why by creeks. Well, you'll see. So here's four creeks in Seattle that are priority watersheds the city has set. And we're going to start, just look at Piper's Creek, which is, here, I'll go back. There's Piper's Creek. You know Carkeek Park? That's Piper's Creek. So there's Piper's Creek coming through Carkeek Park. And at the top, there is a street. This was the Seattle's first, what they called C, or Street Edge Alternative Street. And they said, there were no sidewalks, and they said, we're going to do something different here because we get all of this dirty water coming too fast, too much all at once, the Goldilocks syndrome, into Piper's Creek. It scours out the creek, and it means that we can't have good salmon habitat there. We need gravel for salmon, and if some salmon has worked its way up there and laid eggs, well, those eggs would just be washed out. So they took this street and said, we're going to narrow it so we have less impervious surface, so the more water will soak in, less water runs off, and they created swales, water quality swales, along both sides to hold that water and let it soak in. And here is a picture. It used to be just a straight street with no sidewalks. Now it curves a little bit, which has a kind of nice neighborhood amenity feeling. And then the swale, here's an image of the swale, goes, actually on both sides. It goes along this side and this side. And it's been incredibly successful. In monitoring it, they found out that it can hold up to 99% of what we call the two-year storm event. That means a storm that's big enough that it should only happen every 2 years. So as you know, with climate change, we're having bigger and bigger big storms. And they actually, with this one, hadn't planned to really monitor the water quality. So I'll show you that in the next one. But the main thing is that this actually performed, in terms of holding the water and infiltrating it into the ground, it performed better than anybody ever thought it would. So they said, City of Seattle said, we're going to keep doing this. So the cross street is pretty steep. So they said, we're going to try it on these steep slopes. And this one's called the 110th Cascade. This doesn't look that steep, but it actually slopes down. And so they built these weirs, so the water just went rush all the way down. So it will be held behind there until it either infiltrates or goes through. There's a little notch here that the vegetation is hiding. And on these, that's during construction, they're finding that they're very efficient at removing the pollutants. So taking out the suspended solids, the petroleum hydrocarbons and oil, and the heavy metals, as well as some of the organics here. So they've actually extended it into whole blocks. This is called the Green Grid. They've curved some streets and not others. This is when it was first built, so it's not green yet, but you can, I think, get a good sense of these rain gardens that go all along the edge of the street. Now downtown, has anybody ever seen this? This is by Buster Simpson, does this really perform? Probably not, but it's pretty great art. And nearby then is the Beckoning Cistern. And this actually was modeled after a Michelangelo piece artwork. I can't remember the name, which one it was. It collects water from the roof through these pipes. It holds it in the cistern and then slowly releases it down through these rain gardens that run along the side of Vine Street. They had wanted to actually have a big cistern at the bottom next to the Vine Street pea patch, but for some reason the city just wasn't quite there yet. It took a long time. Now, of course, the city totally wants to do this kind of thing. But it's a pretty cool precedent. Seattle has green roofs, a lot of green roofs. And some of the early ones were on the City Hall and the Justice Center. What do green roofs have to do with water? Anybody know? Yeah?
Stormwater treatment and retention.
Absolutely. So all that soil there is just like those rain gardens. It holds the water, and so it's released more slowly. Some of it evaporates, and it also is cleaned. Sometimes there's a little excess nitrogen in the beginning, but ultimately, when the water does run off, it's clean. So green roofs are definitely a stormwater strategy. And then to our neighbor, Portland, that always seems to be a step ahead of Seattle, well, the C Streets we were first, they've actually tried just a very minimal intervention here of just curbing, extending out the curb, collecting water, and then making these rain gardens, which then also, like that Christchurch examples, pinches down the street and makes a kind of better neighborhood atmosphere. And they actually calculated that all you would need are these two curb bulbs in those soils, and it would treat all the water on that block. Here's Pioneer Market, the parking, the rain gardens just along the street here and in the parking lot. And this is not the greatest photo, but this is the rainwater coming out of the roof. It's a shower head, and then there's a sculpture, and this guy's taking a shower. It's right at the Pioneer Market entry. And then at Portland State University at 12th Avenue, very urban example of a rain garden. Here's just a sidewalk. The water comes in, it's coming down the hill here, comes in underneath this grating, goes into this swale here, and then the excess water goes out the grates to, you know, so that it doesn't flood the sidewalk or anything. It's just this very nice urban amenity that's also doing double duty as treating and slowing down the stormwater. And just around the corner at Portland State is Epler Hall. And Epler Hall takes that water from the roof and it drains over to here to this garden. That drains down to a big cistern that's at the bottom of the system, so the water's coming across like that. And then it's pumped back up to flush the toilets in the building. So there we go. You're getting three uses out of this. Habitat's probably not so great, but you're definitely getting a human amenity plus that infrastructure of reusing the water. All right, the third category here is to look a little bigger scale at whole neighborhoods. And we're back to Seattle. This is High Point, which is in the Longfellow Creek watershed in West Seattle. So here's the Duwamish. Here's where it's located, West Seattle. And when they did the planning for High Point was a Hope Six development to provide both low-income and market-rate housing for residents. It was a low-income housing project previously. They said, okay, we need to meet certain drainage goals that are mandated by the city, and we have to pick a hydrological precondition. Should it be the previous development of housing? Should it be forest, which was originally there? And they said, well, probably really can't achieve forest because forests are the best condition for mitigating stormwater. We'll pick forested grassland. So that's where their goals. It treats 10% of the water in that urban watershed, so pretty big deal, especially for medium density housing. And here's just a bunch of the different suite of strategies. They take the water from the houses, they disconnect the downspout, or they never did connect it, and that goes into the lawn areas, so that just infiltrates into the ground. So that's good. It recharges then the groundwater for the stream, for Longfellow Creek. They take the water from the street. Sometimes the street is permeable concrete, was the first street with permeable concrete in the city, and that infiltrates, or it runs off to the swale on the side of the street, like C Streets. If there's too much there, it'll filter down and be carried out from a pipe to a water quality pond. And then, of course, the trees themselves are a great stormwater device because about 60% of water that hits a tree will be evapotranspired by the tree, or it will just, you know, it'll sit there and evaporate. So trees are great friends with stormwater control. Here's what it looks like. Here's one of those big rain gardens, water quality channels, looking at it from two different directions. And then here's the permeable concrete, which they use both on the street and the sidewalk. Here's one that's like that 110th Cascade with the weirs. It's on the slope. And here's some different types. Here's just grass, but then here's more planted. And then that's the big water quality pond that's at the end of the system and right before it will outflow into Longfellow Creek. And because they did all of these things, they didn't have to make a huge, ugly pond. it's not the most beautiful pond, and unfortunately they had to fence it, but it would have had to have been three times that size if they hadn't tried to infiltrate and been successful at infiltrating all throughout the housing development. And they're also monitoring there and finding out that it treats the water quality storm, which is the storm that comes every 6 months, and it controls the peak flows for the 25 and 100 year storms. That's a pretty major deal. Now, a brand new project, Thornton Place in Seattle, actually the same firm, SVR, did this project. And this is up at the North Gate. It used to be just that giant empty parking lot. These are almost the headwaters of Thornton Creek. I should have pointed out those creeks on the slide. This is high density housing. It's next to a transit development where the transit place where the buses come. So that's good. People can not have to drive their cars. Can live close together. And they took that water. They couldn't quite restore the creek, but they call this the water quality swale that runs between those big high-density housing. This is the adjacent parking lot, so it takes the water from this parking lot. This is what the site used to look, the whole site used to look like. It's actually quite nice housing for being high-density housing. You can look down and see that swale in between. And there's another view of it. And when I was there taking photographs this day, this was the real estate agent or manager, and he was going on and on about the water quality swale and how great it was. And it was just so wonderful to hear someone get it, that this has a huge impact on the quality of the stream, because just like in Piper's Creek, if you can detain and infiltrate this water and clean it before it goes the whole length of Thornton Creek, it's going to have a huge impact on all of Thornton Creek. So it also is a great public amenity and provides habitat. So it's hitting that sweet spot in many ways. I don't know if these guys were really buying it. What do you think? Yeah, I don't know. Probably after they'd lived there a while, they go, oh yeah, this is pretty cool. And of course, this is brand new, so it's still a little bit raw. But all right, I think this is the last of our travels. Back across the Atlantic to Malmö, Sweden, which is just across the bridge from Copenhagen. And this is a housing development called Western Harbor. It was part of a big building exhibition. It's also somewhat high density, and it's on the waterfront. They've designed this so that the higher buildings are around the edges, so that people get maximum views. And then the lower buildings are in the middle. There are these lovely courtyards. Even though it's very dense, there is a huge amount of green and open space. And then this is a water quality feature as well, the inner harbor. So this is just some images of the harbor's edge with this water that is taken off of that water quality thing I just showed you, and just taken down like this. It runs down the step, and then this is all a lovely harbor front. Very urban, but very livable. And then here's the water quality feature with the, it's got these biotopes of different types of habitat. A little small, but oh well. And then the water is taken through the these pedestrian streets mostly. It's not really dirty. Cleaned in these, what they call biotopes, before it empties into the water feature. Here's what it looks like walking through the middle. I thought, oh, I could live in high-density housing. This is pretty good, these courtyards. And you can see this. This is where the water is all taken down the downspouts and carried through and then collected in these courtyards, as well as those biotopes that I showed you. And then there's the water cleansing pond and biotope. And they're doing three more phases of this project as well. All right, are you tired? A lot of traveling. So here's part three. This project that the Green Futures Lab has just gotten a couple of grants for doing just the prototype development, not actually building them yet. But and this is based on this idea. Has anybody seen this PBS special called Poisoned Waters? was on, yeah, this was on last spring on the Chesapeake and Puget Sound and the problems that we're having with Puget Sound. And that the idea that pollution is no longer being seen as the big industries, but it is the new polluters. Oh, we're out of time. Okay, I'm almost done. Okay. And so it's us that's causing problems. So, you know all these problems in Puget Sound, and that we have all of these 6,000 outfalls into Puget Sound. So our proposal here is to come up with prototypes like Waitangi Park that we can use on the waterfront, build them, monitor them, see how efficient they could be at helping our urban stormwater problems in Puget Sound. And there's some images. And finally, the principle of hitting the sweet spot. Oh, this will be on the website, so if you want to go back and read these more carefully, but this idea of closed-loop systems, creating quality habitat with good human experience, and integrating these systems to make great magnet cities. So. If anybody has questions, I'm very willing to talk, but we have to go outside so that the next class can come in. Thank you.